Just so glad. This has just been a great series. For those of you, this is your first time. Just a heads up, you're coming at the end of the movie, but that's all right. Today will still make sense, but we have been wrestling with this question, what do happy couples know? And so far, we've discovered three things. One of the things that happy couples know is that all of us bring into a relationship hopes, dreams, and desires as it pertains to so many things as far as living and money and spending and how we resolve conflict and babies and things like that. But the problem is, and we don't necessarily plan on this, but it so easily happens that we take things that we walk up the aisle with of hopes, dreams, and desires, and that over time in the relationship, maybe it's the first month or the first year or the first couple of years, things begin to get transferred into a different box, and then things begin to feel like expectations. And then we're in this relationship with this person, and we load up this box, and we hand it to them and say, okay, here, make this happen. And so this is one of the things that we've been talking about and wrestling with, and how do we keep things in the hopes, dreams, and desires box? And happy couples know that they need to make a decision. And the decision is that they decide they owe each other everything but are not owed anything in return. This doesn't make any sense. But the closer you get to a happy couple, especially a couple that's gone the distance, you just begin to realize about them. They've either decided or they've come to understand, I owe this person everything, but they don't owe me anything in return. And essentially that in a happy relationship, it's a race to the back of the line. It's a race like, no, how do I lift you up? How do I serve you? They understand this idea of being selfless. And when both parties are doing this in a relationship, that is when something amazing happens. And in a Christian marriage, we looked at a passage that describes a Christian marriage essentially as a submission competition. That each person insists that the other person go first. They insist that the other person is more important. And the third thing that we discovered last week is that sometimes you have to throw things. Now, before you apply this, you need to go back and listen to the entire message. It's a very specific application to this. But that's what we've learned so far. And again, if you've missed any of this series, some of this, like, on its own is just not going to make sense. And this is just so important if you're single, because the best time to figure out how to have a great relationship is before the first date. And if you're dating or engaged, the best time to figure out how to have a great marriage is before the wedding day. Just in case you didn't know that. And if you are married, I mean, you can never stop investing in your relationship to work to make it better. So you can go to newlifewichita.com. You can watch, you can download the podcast, but I will say the visuals will help. So I encourage you to do that because today we're coming to the fourth thing that happy couples know, and it's this, that happy couples know they have a choice. Happy couples know they have a choice. Today I want to talk about perhaps the single most important choice that you will make as a couple or in a relationship as it relates to becoming a happy couple and making the relationship so attractive and something that stays attractive to you and just gets better. So I want to talk about a decision or a choice, but oftentimes it doesn't feel like a choice. It feels like it's just a reaction that I don't really have a choice or a decision, but you do. And happy couples make the choice that we're going to talk about today. So what is the choice? And the answer is found in a letter written by the Apostle Paul that he writes to a group of Gentile Christians in the city of Corinth, and it's in the first letter. So these were non-Jewish, new Christians, and they're trying to sort out this whole Christian thing, and how do I live this out and move from pagan worship to following Jesus? What does that look like? And one of the things that the Apostle Paul had to do in this context is he had to help the pagans understand that were turning to Jesus. Not only is there one God, not many gods, but that there is he's a very different God. He's very different from all of their pagan gods. Because in pagan worship, the gods did not care about people. In pagan worship, the gods toyed with people, they manipulated people, and some legends they mated with people, but the gods did not really care about people. So consequently, in pagan religion, there was no morality. There were no ethics. In other words, you didn't have to do anything on earth towards other people to be right with the gods. In fact, you made sacrifices to the gods. You sacrificed things. You sacrificed things that were important to you. You sacrificed animals. In some cultures, they sacrificed people because the whole point was to make sacrifices to keep the gods happy so that your crops would grow, so that you would win in battle, so that your family or your children would be healthy. and that ultimately you would have a good standing with God. And for some that would say, you know, I'm a Christian, one of the struggles is that this is kind of how their faith works too. You know, God is kind of like Santa. You know, he's got a list. He's checking it twice. I just need to do enough good things to stay off of the naughty list, at least right before I die. And the Apostle Paul, he shows up to these primarily Gentile environments and going, okay, this God that I've introduced you to is completely different. This God actually cares about people. He actually cares about creation. So consequently, in order to please this God, it's not about sacrifices in the way that you think sacrifices. Instead, in order to please this God, you actually love the people around you. And the Apostle Paul introduces this radical idea that originated with Jesus, and it was the difference between a horizontal versus vertical religion. In the old version, in every temple model, in every old version of religion, the religion is, I'm going to treat God the way that God wants to be treated so that I have a good and right standing with God. I want him to be happy with me. The new horizontal way, the Jesus way, the horizontal religion, I'm going to try to treat you the way that God has treated me. And he's shown lavish love and lavish kindness for me. So Paul, in this first letter, he's just finished telling these people that he's writing to, the way that you treat people is the number one manifestation of showing that you love God or that you respect what God has done for you or what he's called you to do. And what Paul writes, this is one of my favorite passages in the New Testament because it's so clarifying. It is so helpful. It is so practical. This specific passage has shaped my life. It absolutely has shaped my marriage and how I show love to Shauna and the way that she shows love to me. It's in 1 Corinthians. It's a very popular chapter. This chapter is so significant. I've just taught through it more times than I can count. Some of you had all or portions of this chapter read at your wedding. In fact, I unpacked this message just 6 weeks ago in a wedding I did in Kansas City. And I tell every couple before I do their wedding, if you were to ever memorize Scripture, memorize New Testament, there are two passages that I would, if you would memorize these and apply these in your relationship, you will have something amazing. This is one of them. The other, if you're curious, is 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 8 through 12. So I love this passage because Paul gives us a radical definition of love. That in the Greek and in the Western culture, there are different types of love, different forms of love. In the Greek, there were at least 8. There was philia, which was like brotherly or affectionate love, thus, you know, Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. There was eros, which is intimate or sexual love, thus the word erotic. But in this passage, Paul introduces and then he defines a form of love that originated with Jesus and that becomes the foundation of every other form of love. It becomes a foundation of building and sustaining every other form of love. It's agape love. It's selfless love. And again, it's so applicable. It's life-changing. It's relationship-defining. And most of it makes sense. But there's one line in here. And if you grew up, you go into church, or grew up a Bible reader, you may have just like blown by this. And maybe it didn't totally make sense. Because if you actually look at it, it doesn't make sense. But in this line, we find the secret or the decision that happy couples make. So I'm going to walk through a bit of what may be familiar, and then we're going to get to this one line that doesn't make any sense, and then we're going to camp out on it for just a few minutes. He says, if I speak in the tongues of men or of angels, but I don't have love, I'm only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. Now, leading up to this verse, he just finished addressing to these formerly pagan Christians in their previous religions that they would have ecstatic utterances. Essentially, they would try to speak other languages, or so they thought. After Jesus departed this earth, there's what's called the Day of Pentecost, and on this particular day, God showed up in an extraordinary way and gifted the disciples in Jerusalem in this particular moment the ability to speak in languages and dialects that they had not previously been able to speak, they had not known. And this happened more than once, but many of the pagans kind of grabbed a hold of this and said, well, this kind of lines up with what we're kind of used to in our religion anyways, because they were always trying to attempt to speak in the languages of angels or the languages of the gods. And so they would do this and try to do this. But he had just finished telling them, okay, there are varied aspects of the religious experience. There's different roles and gifts, but don't fool yourself. None of that is the main thing. None of that is the main thing. Even if you were able to tap into the languages of angels or of gods or any of that, if you don't have love, it's just a lot of noise. That's all it is. He goes on, if I have the gift of prophecy, that is, I can tell the future and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge. In other words, I can be the smartest person in the room. If I have a faith that can move mountains, whatever perfect faith is, I have it. But I do not have love, I'm nothing. Paul says, even if you're the smartest person in the room, you can answer any question about the Bible or Scripture. You can answer any question. You have big faith, but you don't have love. You're literally a nobody. Paul says ability, knowledge, and believing the right things are not the measure. The measure of a Jesus follower is love. Love is the measure. And if I give all I possess to the poor, not 10%, not 20%, everything. If I give everything to the poor, I give my body to hardship that I may boast, but I do not have love, I gain nothing. In other words, anyone who gives to get gets nothing from God. Anybody who gives to get gets nothing from God, which is a side note, is kind of the nail in the coffin for the so-called prosperity gospel. But that's a conversation for another day. Here's the question. What is have love? See, if I did a survey of the room and asked, do you have love? Like almost everybody in this room would say, yeah, I have love. I have love. You know, because it sounds like something on the inside, right? It sounds something like something internal. So some sort of feeling. I feel warm and fuzzy, you know, when I think of you. In a romantic relationship, when I look at you, you know, when I look at my wife, I feel. You know, it's like I have a feeling. You know, I spend time with you. Baby, I have not lost that loving feeling. Or you have lost that loving feeling. Or I feel compassionate towards people who are going through a hard time. Or I feel compassionate towards that couple or towards those kids. I feel, therefore, I have love. And so Paul's trying to make clear to these first century pagans and to us, these Christians, that it is bigger than that. It's bigger than an internal thing. It's bigger than feelings. And to achieve this vertical thing, God requires this horizontal thing, a very practical one. So he says, when I say have love, here's what I'm talking about. He's talking about stuff that you do. So he says love, the kind of have love that I'm talking about. Love is patient. It means that I choose to put somebody else's hopes, dreams, desires, and needs first. I don't push, rush, or pressure you to do things my way at my speed. I choose to get in the back of the line. Love is kind. Kindness is, I'm going to loan you my strength for your benefit. Whatever it is that I could offer that can benefit you, that's what I'm going to do in a way that encourages, benefits you. Love does not envy. It's not jealous. That when you're with somebody and they're better at something than you, you know, they get more attention than you. They are the life of the party when they walk in, you know, that you go, like, I celebrate that. I'm not going to be jealous of that. Or maybe you see some other husband, some other wife, and, you know, they seem to have it better. No, I'm not going to be envious. I'm not going to be jealous of that. Love does not boast. Love does not try to one-up and shut up the other person. Well, I scrubbed the tub. Well, great. I scrubbed the toilet after Mexican food night. So, you know, just saying. Instead of choosing to one-up and put myself above you, I'm going to let you shine, especially in social situations. I'm going to put the spotlight on you. I'm going to let you be center stage. I'm going to let you get the praise and the good words. I'm going to let the attention be on you. I'm not going to rob you of that and try and take it for myself. And love is not proud. It's not arrogant. I don't look down on you as less than. And this is so important. It's big because typically we marry somebody very different than us and very different in personality. So I'm not going to look down on you as less than or stupid. I'm not going to belittle your feelings because your feelings and your struggles are different than my feelings and struggles. Your feelings are your feelings. I'm going to honor that. I'm not going to belittle that. I'm not going to be proud. Love does not dishonor others. In other words, love decides I will not say or do anything that dishonors you. Especially in public. One of the things that breaks my heart is when I'm with couples and one or the other will belittle or put down or make a joke at the expense of their partner. That should never happen. Like, why? And or, you know, it doesn't dishonor and say, you know, why can't you be more like so-and-so's girlfriend or boyfriend or husband and wife? Why can't you be more like so-and-so's husband? Love does not dishonor. What that means is if doing or saying this publicly or privately is dishonoring to you, I'm not going to do it. I would be sinning against you to dishonor you. Whether or not, you know, I'm one of those, I can even find a verse to justify it. I'm not going to do it. If it's dishonoring, if it's off limits. Love is not self-seeking. It's that I'm going to put you ahead of me. I'm going to make fulfilling your hopes, dreams, your desires. I'm going to make it an adventure. I'm going to make it a priority. Love is not easily angered. Love doesn't have a temper. And I want to be honest. This can be so easy for us to miss, especially if you're tired or you're hangry. Some of you can testify, or you've had a rough day. It is so easy to get this wrong, and we can all get this wrong. You know, where your partner, you know, they say or they do something in certain situations and you've had a day, you're in a state of mind, it just rubs you the wrong way. It should only rub you the wrong way about here, but it rubs you like at a level 10, whatever it is. And it's just something you've got to watch for. And when you get it wrong, you need to catch it as quickly as you can and own it. Because love chooses, no, I'm not going to let my personal junk or my mommy or my daddy issues or whatever my day was or I need a taco, whatever it is, I'm not going to let it cause me to act out or speak out in anger. And this is a big one. Love keeps no records of wrongs. And part of it's like, can that even be done? It's like, but imagine what it would be like in a love relationship with someone that kept no record of wrongs. Then he says something that's a little bit tricky. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. And we'll come back to that in a minute, because then he gives us sort of a rapid-fire list of what love is. He says, love always protects, always trusts, always hopes, and always perseveres. Love always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Now, there's one of this list that if you pay attention to, it doesn't make sense, because one of these is not completely dependent on the lover. It's dependent on the love-e, and it's this one, always trust. It always trusts, because I can always protect a person even when they're wrong. I can always hope that things will get better. I can always persevere through difficult struggles or push through troubles, whatever it is, but always trust. And literally the Greek word is believes, or always believes everything. In other words, love defaults to trust. And this is a keystone habit for happy couples. Now, let me illustrate it this way. In every relationship, not just in romantic dating or married, whatever it is, in every relationship, from time to time, there's going to be a gap between your expectations and what ultimately happens. There's going to be a gap between what we expect and what we experience. And every single time, even though we don't realize it, in that moment, we have a choice. We think it's a reaction, but it's a choice. That when there's a gap between what we were told someone was going to do, or somebody was going to handle, or they led us to believe that they were going to do, and what they actually did, there's going to be a gap. And then we choose what we put in that gap. And we either choose to believe the best. We choose in that moment, like, you know, I don't know why this happened, or why they dropped the ball, or whatever it is, or why they're late, or why she didn't. I didn't know why he didn't follow through, but I'm going to choose to believe the best. I'm going to assume they have a good explanation, and when I get all of the information, it'll make sense. Or we assume the worst. That she did it again, he did it again. Of course, I kind of expected it. I mean, that's just usually how it is. Of course, he dropped the ball. Happy couples make it a habit to choose and believe the best. This is what it means to believe all things. It's a choice. In the moment, it doesn't feel like a choice. But again, I want this to sink in. Every single time when there's a gap between what you were told and what you were led to believe and what was promised and what you actually experienced, there's this gap. You know, he didn't come through. She was late. I don't know where he is. I don't know why he didn't. I don't know why she didn't or why she did. Every time there's a gap, we make a choice what we put here. We believe the best or we assume the worst. And happy couples choose to believe the best until they just can't believe the best anymore. Now, Paul wrote these words 2,000 years ago. So this is amazing, because in 2005, author and speaker Marcus Buckingham, he wrote a book called One Thing You Need to Know. This is a business book. It's about business management, leadership, and becoming a better and making progress. I've had the chance to hear Marcus live several times in my life, and I like listening. He's got an English accent, which that always makes somebody sound 10 times smarter than they are, right? So, and he wrote this book, and when he wrote this book, he wasn't a Christian. This book was written purely from a secular, humanist, data point of view research. So no religious agenda. And in this book, he cites a 20-year study that for over 20 years, there was a group that studied happy couples in the U.S., the Canada, and the U.K. And they were looking for common denominators. And to be clear, these were couples that had gone the distance. They had been together for at least a certain amount of time. They still enjoyed each other's company. These were not couples that were just kind of grunting it out and fighting it through and we're staying together for the kids. We're miserable, but we can't afford to get split up. That's not these couples. These couples, they've been together a long time and they were in an enjoyable relationship. And they were asked all these different questions to discover what is the common denominator for happy couples. And when they went into the study, like any researcher does, they went in with some assumptions about happy couples that had gone the distance and who still loved each other and being together after a long time. And their primary assumption was that they would discover that these couples that over time just kind of lowered their expectations of the person that they were in a relationship with. That they lower their expectations as it pertained to their motives, their character, and their virtue. In other words, over time, they just decide, well, you know, he's not as great as I thought he was, or she's not as great as I thought she was, so I'm just going to lower my expectations. I'm going to have a more realistic view of my husband or of my wife. But the study showed the exact opposite. In fact, it's a really fascinating study. In fact, each person had an opportunity to rate themselves and then rate their spouse in a number of categories of attributes and qualities, and consistently, happy couples, one would rate their partner higher than they would rate themselves. In other words, they gave their partner higher scores than they gave themselves in all these categories. And they had, as it turned out, an unrealistic positive view of the person they were in a relationship with. In fact, one of the summations of this study was love is actually blind. Because they seem to be blind to the deficiencies in their spouse and partner. And this positive view that they had toward the other person created what they termed an upward spiral of love. An upward spiral of love. And here's how it worked. Illusion created conviction or strong belief. Conviction led to security. Security fostered intimacy, and intimacy fostered love. So the illusion, she is the greatest on the planet, he is the greatest on the planet, it created this conviction. They believed it for so long, it actually became a conviction, like, no, I don't just believe it, like, they are, like, I know your spouse is great, but mine is better, kind of thing. The conviction led to a sense of security. You know, because they're the greatest, because I believe this, I'm convicted, they are the greatest, I feel secure in this relationship. There's a high level of trust. And high levels of trust always lead to intimacy. Why? Because of what intimacy is. Intimacy is the fearless reveal. Intimacy is, I trust all of me to you. I feel I don't have to be on guard. I don't feel like there's anything I have to hide because I feel like I can trust all of me to you. That's the essence of intimacy. And that intimacy fostered love. And you know what the love did? It circled back up and just reaffirmed even more the illusion, and which created more conviction, which created more security, which created more intimacy. And so they said it just kind of built on itself. It just goes up and up and up in an upward spiral of love. And at the end of the study, here was their recommendation, which makes Paul's 2,000-year-old point. Their recommendation was, in a relationship, when there's a gap, find the most generous explanation. Find the most generous explanation, that when there's a gap between what I expected and what I experienced, in your mind, come up with the most generous explanation for your partner's behavior and believe it. Come up with the most generous explanation for the other person's behavior and then just decide to believe it. Believe all things. Love always believes. Choose always to believe the best. Now, obviously, there are things that make this challenging and difficult. And again, I've been doing what I do for a long time. I've talked and walked through so many difficult situations with couples. And I myself have been with the same woman for over 30 years, so I'm not naive. I get it. There's obstacles to this. But regardless of the obstacles, and we'll talk about two in just a second, but I don't want you to miss the point. Every single time there's a gap. Even when it's the same gap over and over, every single time, what you place in the middle is going to be relationship defining. You decide what you place there, and you will either decide to believe the best or assume the worst. But whichever way you go, it is a decision, it's a choice. And that's what I don't want you to miss as we wrap up this series. Now, here are the obstacles to this. One is what we experience. Right? I mean, it's like, well, he did it again. She did it again. I mean, just ask my wife. Like, I did it. Like, I joked, I just want to get a t-shirt that just says, I'm sorry. Because that I felt like I was apologizing so much. You know, it's just like clockwork. And the other obstacle is what we bring into the relationship is who we are. Because let's be honest. None of us show up in a relationship all squeaky clean, you know, blank slate, right? We pull up our moving truck full of baggage and other stuff, and we showed up with stuff and all of our luggage and our daddy issues and our mommy issues and our grandfather wounds and my older brother did this and former boss wounds, or I was in this toxic, you know, boyfriend-girlfriend relationship, whatever it was, or we were dating, all these wounds. We bring all that stuff with us. We bring all of our history. We bring our baggage. We bring our fears. We bring our insecurities. We bring our own personal doubts, and some people, therefore, have a more difficult time trusting than others, and it makes sense. But then it goes back to the point. You're in a relationship that's struggling with somebody that's struggling to trust. Like, why can't you just trust me instead of saying, you know what, there's reasons why they struggle to trust, so I'm going to assume the best. I'm going to show understanding. See, we bring our history and all these things into that. And because of just the baggage that we bring in or fears or insecurities, there's certain things that could be said or done that trigger those insecurities, those behaviors. And so, but even with all the junk and all the stuff you bring in, even with the inconsistency of the other person in your relationship, it's still a choice every single time. And it just to dig a little bit more, suspicion is a self-fulfilling prophecy. What I mean is if you're in a relationship and your pattern is just to assume the worst long enough in a relationship, eventually you will find something to actually be suspicious about. And here's why. Because this other person, when they're in a relationship where there is low trust, they're walking on pins and needles all the time. When you're in a relationship with a person, you just kind of feel like he or she is just constantly looking for you to do something wrong and for you to trip up. You're never at ease. You're always careful. You're always guarded. You're so cautious. And you'll just be so controlled in your behaviors and your words that it will appear that you're up to something, even though you're not. And it sets the other person up to do the very thing that you fear they will do, though they never had any intention of doing it, because suspicion and low trust in a relationship is almost always a self-fulfilling prophecy. It sets the stage for the very thing you fear the most, and that's why you need to pay attention to who you are, not just what the other person is doing. In fact, I can't tell you, every single couple that I ever worked with, and I really don't do marriage counseling anymore, but back in the day, I would meet with these couples, but the very first meeting, I would tell them, I'll agree to meet with you on a weekly basis, but here's the thing you have to commit to, one of the things. And one of them was that you're going to stop looking and pointing the finger at the other person in this relationship, and you're going to start looking in the mirror. Even though it may be totally lopsided and whatever kind of presenting situation was coming into the room, we each bring something that is either going to continue to be part of the problem or part of the solution. But it begins with looking in the mirror. So with all that in mind, I want to go back and look at two or three of these verses that we just quickly went through in 1 Corinthians 13, because they lean into this powerful, powerful principle that we get to choose every single time. So look at this now. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with truth. You know what that means? It means that love doesn't try to catch the other person doing wrong. Love doesn't busy itself to try and build a case against the other person, like you did this or said this. Love doesn't keep score of the past. Instead, he said, love always protects. Protects what? Protects the relationship from assuming the worst. Love is protective of the relationship and the other person by assuming the best and by being patient and kind. And love knows that whatever I choose to put in the middle between expectations and experience is going to impact the relationship. Yes, this is what I thought they were going to do, but they didn't. They didn't do what I thought they were going to do. We'll have to talk about that. But again, what I put in this gap is going to impact the relationship for the long term. And perhaps it'll impact it more than the gap that the other person created. Then he says, love always hopes. Love trends positive. I'm just not going to allow myself to get in this pattern of going negative, and love always perseveres. That there may be some doubt, there may be some negative, there may be some struggles and challenges, there may be some things from the past that come roaring in to the future. We're facing difficulty and challenge, but love decides, I'm going to persevere. I'm going to fight alongside. I'm going to take my cues from my Heavenly Father, who his love to me, that says, with all of your junk and all of your shortcomings and all of these other things, I took action first because I love you. I'm going to continue to love you. Never will I leave you. Never will I forsake you. My commitment to you is forever. So here's the question, based on your personality or based on your experiences, based on what you know about yourself, do you believe the best or do you assume the worst? Which way do you go? When there's a gap, do you find yourself going, you know what, I'm sure there's a good reason, or either person like, he better have a good explanation, or you know, she better have a good reason for this. I'm already mad. I don't even have all the information yet, but I'm mad. Soon as she gets home, the garage door goes up, he finally calls, she finally calls, he finally texts me, whatever it is. At best, I'm going to just remain calm, but I'm already assuming the worst, and at worst, I'm just bringing the hammer down. You know, they're quickly going to discover how unhappy I am. You know, which way do you go? And I just want you to know, regardless of who you're in a relationship with, and regardless of the dynamic, and what he's like or what she's like, it's your choice every single time. And I know you want to push back, go, Chad, yeah, but, you know, this and this, all these yeah, buts. I get it. But I'm telling you, it's always a choice. Besides, what are the options? Because here's option B. Option B, delight in uncovering mistakes, thrive on speculation, assume the worst, and embrace doubt. Now imagine sitting down with your future or your current kids, and they're older, about to get married, and you're going to give them advice about moving into marriage in a permanent relationship. Honey, you just lay a trap. He'll step into it eventually. And you just go, I got you. I knew this was going to happen. I knew you were that kind of person. Or just be looking for stuff. And as soon as they trip up, you tell them, gotcha. Here's what happy couples know. When there's a gap, and there's always going to be gaps, you decide what goes in the gap. You always decide. And you're always going to come out better if the habit, if the pattern is to lean towards, I'm going to believe the best. So here's your homework assignment for those of you that are coupled, to just do for a week and just decide. Even if it's 9 times out of 10, even if there's no good excuse, you know, he did it, whatever, just for a week, decide, you know what, before I get all the information, before he calls, before I get a text back, whatever it is, before we get together tonight, I'm going to come up with a generous explanation. And I'm going to choose to believe it. I'm going to choose to believe my own generous explanation for his or her behavior, and I'm just going to do this for a week. Then after that, I can go back to being angry, but for a week. Because here's the objective reality. Our hearts, and ultimately our behavior, are drawn to trust. The people that we want to let down the least are the people that we feel like they believe in us the most, right? Like people that we look up to and admire, and we just feel like no matter what, they just believe in us. Like we don't want to let them down. And when you create an atmosphere When you create an atmosphere that defaults to trust and believing in, you create an environment of high acceptance. So, and you create an environment that actually motivates the other person to try and become as good as you apparently see them. I mean, it's amazing how this works. And I'm telling you, I have experienced this firsthand in my life. I am convinced that my wife is the best wife on the planet. I know you dudes got great wives, but I'm just telling you. And the reason why is because we've been in this relationship, and especially the early years, like high-level ADHD, should be on Ritalin all the time. That's ready, fire, aim. That was my standard. And my wife, woman with a plan, there's details, there are rules, there's black and white. I'm like, what suggested speed limit? It's just what, you know. And the thing is that she got into this pattern where initially it was harder. It was hard to not take things personal, where she asked me to do something or told me some information, and like I walk out of the room, I've got the memory span of a gnat, and like 2 minutes later, like, what were we talking about? What were you fighting about? That's never a good thing. And at first it was hard to not take personal, and then she discovered that that's just, it's the way my brain works. And over time, she became more gracious. Instead of coming at me like you don't care, or I don't matter, or I've told you this 1,000 times. I mean, all these things that she rightfully could have done. She instead began to be gracious. She began to help do things to help me remember. And so you know what this motivated me to do? It motivated me to want to be a more remembering individual, more sensitive to the things that were important to her, because she was gracious to me. So like I'm like post-its everywhere. Like even this morning, I committed to do something. I had a post-it on the garage door. So as I walked out, like, oh, I'm supposed to do that. Her love motivated me to do that. She assumed the best instead of assuming the worst about my character. So that's just one snapshot of how this works. Because when you create this atmosphere, this amazing thing happens. Now, does this mean you don't ever have difficult conversations or conflicts that you have to resolve? Of course it doesn't. You still got to work through this. You have difficult conversations. But when, at the same time, when it's over and you talk about it, you go right back to it. Because the past is the past. I'm not keeping score. Even if the last 10 out of 10 times you dropped the ball, there was no excuse, this 11th time, I'm going to believe in you. I'm going to come up with a generous explanation. I'm going to choose to believe the best, because that's what happy couples know. Let's pray. Father, I thank you so much that we have what we do have of the New Testament writers, Paul's writing, that we get this opportunity to have this definition of love. And I pray for every one of us in this room, in all of our relationships, to have this kind of love, but especially in our romantic relationships, our marriage relationships, Father, that you would help us to have this kind of selfless love towards one another. And God, we need your help, because just left to ourselves, it's just not going to happen, because we're just naturally selfish. So Father, I pray for everyone in this room, for those that are not yet in a relationship, that you would take this in this series and just shape them and prepare them for something even greater than they would have had. For those that are in relationships, Father, and I know there's so much to their stories, but it's no surprise to you, and your way is trustworthy and actually brings healing and strength. And I pray, God, that you would help every couple to work through this, to live it out, and to experience this, the great thing that you will do. I pray all of it in the name of Jesus. Amen.